So today it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ricardo Nogales to the Tuesday seminar. Ricardo is a research officer at the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative since 2018. He holds a Bachelor of Science and Master of Science in Economics and a PhD in Econometrics, all from the University of Geneva. And before he joined Oxford, he was a professor of economics at the School of Economics and Finance of the Universidad Privada Boliviana in Bolivia, and a research assistant at the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development in Switzerland. So his research focused on development economics, poverty reduction, human development, and he did quite a bit of extensive research on the different issues with the IDB, UNDP, ILO, World Bank, and others. So he has been also an external consultant for several public organizations in Bolivia, including the Program for Strategic Research, the Central Bank, and the Ministry of Economics and Public Finance. His research has been published or is forthcoming in World Development, Social Indicators Research, Latin American Research Review, and Markets Emerging Markets Finance and Trade. So Ricardo presents today a paper that research conducts together with Christian Oldiges, also from the University of Oxford, on the issue changing conflicts and human deprivation in Nigeria, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ethiopia. So together Ricardo and Christian have contributed also to the Conflict Platform project, also located at the CCW Center, and we participated in several workshops, and they will be also both contributing to a forthcoming special issue on different epistemologies and methodologies to understand changes in armed conflicts. And next term, also to mention that, the CCW Center is bringing also a group of speakers together in the Tuesday seminar on topics related to the Conflict Platform. So we look forward to seeing you also next term. So again, a warm welcome, dear Ricardo, and now the floor is yours for the next 45 minutes.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. And thank you to the center, to Liz, to Kate, and to Annette for having me here today to present some preliminary work on something that has slightly changed in terms of titles. So we're trying to assess and revisit the connection between conflict and well-being, and we try to see to what extent we can say new things about this connection in sub-Saharan Africa. So as Marcus said, this is a joint work, ongoing work with my co-author, Christian Oldiges, who's also a research officer at the University of Oxford. So just an overview of the presentation. I'm going to be presenting the main ideas behind the introduction, the background, and the motivation for our study. Then I will be challenging how we should conceive well-being when we think about its connection to conflict and how do we define developative space. Of course, I'm going to go through concepts and methods and, of course, data, because that's going to be a very important limiting factor. Then I'm going to go a little bit deeper into the connection itself, talking about the nature of conflict and the data availability. And then I'm going to show you some preliminary results. They're going to have two kinds of results first. We're going to have a graphical representation first, and then I'm going to go a little bit deeper into some kind of model-based analysis. And then, of course, the concluding remarks are just thoughts at this stage, and then I hope that they open the floor for some nice discussion and debates around the things that I'm going to put on the table today. So I guess it's very well known for all of us that armed conflict reshapes the social tissue and it reshapes people's lives in many ways. And we have a lot of evidence when it comes to cross-national comparisons that focus on monetary aspects of welfare, mainly GDP or, the economic making machine when it comes to money. And you have very interesting works related on that, and it's a very valid and ongoing strand of research when it comes to the connection between policy and conflict. But then you also have a growing strand of research that says that a lot of aspects of people's lives are reconfigured, not only their purchasing power, such as, for example, you have a very nice study by Bertoni and co-authors who find negative effects, of course, in terms of school attendance in Nigeria because of Boko Haram. You also have some long-term negative effects in Vietnam related to mental health issues. And then you also have a little bit more of a connecting mechanism when it comes to conflict inducing job loss and that being the cause of school and dropout in Palestine, for example, as a connecting mechanism or a causal chain, if you want. So I guess that you have more and more evidence showing that when you focus on monetary aspects of poverty, you only get a thin overview of what's happening with people's lives when it relates to conflict. But then also you see that there are other things that are going on, because sometimes you see that conflict reshapes the social tissue in a way that you have some emerging markets, informal markets that are set in place, where you would actually see that a certain aspect of people's lives or purchasing power is actually not protected, because it's not the right word, But the extent to which it's hindered by conflicts can actually be a little bit mitigated because of these informal tissues and institutions that are reconfigured in conflictive areas. So with this very preliminary research overview, literature overview, we ask, what if we actually take into account the very intuitive fact that when a person or a household experiences conflict, then not only purchasing power, not only school attendance, not only mental health are affected, but they're all affected at the same time. So one thing that is actually not necessarily very prevalent in these kind of studies is the interconnection or the simultaneous nature of these effects. So they try to focus very rightfully in one specific aspect, one at a time, and they allow for a very rich understanding of what happens with one particular aspect. But that amounts to actually thinking of well-being as a cumulative aspect of, say, isolated deprivations. And you don't take into account the fact that they often manifest themselves simultaneously, so you don't take into account the depth or the intensity of deprivations. So in that context, in this paper we argue, to what extent do the experience of simultaneous well-being deprivations can be related to armed conflict? So what we're challenging is the fact that the evaluative space can be broadened up and can be enriched to come up with other things that are not necessarily looking that are not necessarily looked at, but that don't require necessarily new data to be analyzed. Of course, we're not trying to draw on generalities because we do acknowledge that every context is very, very different. But we try to see to what extent we can have cross-national comparisons to the extent possible. So that's why we focus on empirical examples of these three cases, which were chosen for many reasons. One of them, I have to acknowledge that it's data availability, but also because they have similar levels of welfare deprivations according to UNDP standards. So we can actually have some kind of welfare deprivations that start from a similar aspect, if you want. So if we challenge then the concept of well-being, then how do we conceptualize that? I think it's very intuitive and very easy to understand that it is multifaceted in nature because you have a lot of strands in terms of policymaking and international policy agendas that very highly, very, very powerfully pitch the fact that poverty, for example, is multidimensional, that well-being is multidimensional. That is reflected in the SDGs, for example, in Agenda 2030, where goal one, for example, is not to reduce poverty by monetary terms, but it is to reduce poverty in all its forms and dimensions, whatever that may be. You do have that also reflected in more qualitative studies, such as the one conducted by the World Bank, which is named Voices of the Poor, where actually people were asked how they live in general when they face poverty, and they actually said that many more things are lacking in their lives other than just not having money in the pocket. When you think of the quality of life in the Sen-Stiglitz-Fitoussi Commission that started thinking about how to replace, in a certain way, GDP as a measure of development, have also adopted this point of view. You have the Atkinson report, and then of course you have measures that have tried to pragmatize this vision to say the quantitative realm, such as UNDP's HDI. Now, when we think about multidimensionality, and we're willing to accept that that is the case, then what do we mean by that term? A lot of academic research actually think that multidimensionality means accounting for a lot of aspects at the same time. That is looking at the dashboard effects. Like, we're looking at health, we're looking at education, we're looking at work, we're looking at money, we're looking at a dashboard of things. That's only one part of the problem, because as Atkinson very powerfully stated, actually multidimensionality has to take into account not only many aspects, but also how they are connected. In terms of more quantitative aspects, you have to take into account the joint distribution of deprivations and not necessarily single isolated marginal distributions, because they come from a joint distribution. In terms of statistical evaluation, that is important because the space of evaluation is different. If we take into account, and I'm going to show you with an example, if we take into account the isolated distribution of one thing and we don't connect it with the isolated distribution of other things, we're missing out information. Now, there are many ways of doing that, and I'm going to present the one that we work with at the research center here at the university. It's not the only one. I'm happy to discuss that afterwards, but perhaps that's the subject for a different series, which is called the Alkire-Foster method, and it's a part of the family of the dual counting approach. I'm going to explain how that works in a while for you to have a good glance of what exactly we're postulating as the evaluative space of well-being in its connection to conflict. Now, this method, of course, is the one that UNDP and we use to measure multidimensional poverty all over the developing world. But it is also the underlying technique for UNICEF multiple overlapping deprivation analysis, UNICEF's MODA. And it is also the one that the World Bank is using to construct what they call the multidimensional poverty measure. So what does this mean? Say, for example, that you have two regions in a country. So you have region one and you have region two. There's a similar amount of conflict, if you want, in both regions. Say we accept multidimensional poverty, and we think that four aspects are relevant to assess the effect of conflict on people's lives: income, education, shelter, and water. And we see here that in every row we have, say, a household. So we have a society composed of two regions, where in each region we have four households. Now, the D here stands for deprived, so they fall below the poverty line. They say nobody's educated in that household, they don't have adequate shelter by, say, SDG standards, and they don't have access to safe drinking water. Oh, sorry, I knew that would happen. So that's what D stands for. They're deprived. And D stands for non-deprived. So we don't detect that they have fallen, say, below a certain threshold level. So if you see the marginal distributions and you assess what is the proportion of people who are deprived in income or the poverty rate, you would conclude that one out of four households are deprived. So you would come up with some kind of a headcount ratio of 25%, right? Which is exactly what happens in this society. It is also 25%. If you take into account what is the proportion of people who lack education or who are deprived in education by certain standards, again, you would find a 1/4 or 25% of prevalence. And you would also find the same conclusion here. And in the end, this example shows that if you take marginal distributions, you will never be able to detect differences in those distributions, because you will always come to the conclusion that both of them are deprived in 25% in each dimension isolated, right? But then, of course, you only have to look at it for a couple of seconds to realize that that's not true, because one thing that is completely overlooked is the fact that intensity of poverty is different. Here, the deprivations, if you want, are distributed evenly among the population, whereas here they're completely concentrated in one household, right? So that intensity of poverty cannot be uncovered unless you take a different route and you try to establish the extent to which deprivations are connected and whether the likelihood of one manifesting itself is linked or not to the likelihood of other ones being manifested as well. So that is the reason, or that is the reasoning behind the space of evaluation. We're not saying that the proportion of people deprived in each aspect is not important. Of course it is. But we have to go a little bit beyond that to assess the depth of poverty, or the depth of deprivations, when we think of how conflict is associated with well-being in general. Because, of course, I mean, not only for the sake of understanding the problem, but also because in terms of policymaking, of course, policymaking is radically different in this situation or in this situation, right? Presumably, targeting, for example, is much more difficult here because deprivations are scattered across the population, whereas here, targeting is easier in a way because we only have to find the one person who suffers from everything, yeah? So how does this work in this method that we propose? So we have the four households. And we can end up with different key elements when it comes to thinking about what we want to evaluate as a measure of well-being. So the first would be, and that's why it's called the counting approach, you can actually count the number of deprivations that each person faces. Here, for example, you would have zero deprivations faced by the first household. Here you have two deprivations faced by the second household. Here you have four deprivations faced by the third, and then you have one deprivation faced by the other one. So once you count the deprivations, you can redefine the people or the households who you understand to be poor. So for example, in this case, you need to set a poverty line. So the World Bank, for example, says poor is somebody who doesn't make or who doesn't spend more than 190 a day, or a household that doesn't spend more than 190 a day per capita. That is a poverty line. So here, for example, we can say poor household is going to be a household where you have two or more deprivations that are observed. Or you can have three or more deprivations, or you can have one or more deprivations. So you can have different poverty lines, right? I'm not going to enter into the debate of how we set the poverty line, because it's a different problem when it comes to poverty measurement, but we're going to adopt a measure that already has a poverty line adopted by UNDP. I'm going to mention it, but of course, if you can, if you want, we can discuss that afterwards. So here, for example, in this slide, we just, for the sake of the illustration, we just adopted a poverty line of 2. So a household will be considered poor if they face 2 out of the 4 deprivations. So if they're deprived in half of the considered indicators. Now, this is the reason why these people are highlighted, because they are the poor households in the society. Now the question can come, so in this case, the incidence of multidimensional poverty would be 50%, 2 out of 4. Now the question arises as to how poor they are. Because of course, they're both poor, but they're both poor with different intensities. This household, the third one, is much poorer than the first one, say the first poor one here. So we can actually measure the average number of deprivations faced by the poor. So here, for example, this household is deprived in 2 out of 4, so they have an intensity of deprivation of 50%, and this household is deprived in 4 out of 4, so they have an intensity of deprivation of 100%. So the average of those numbers is going to be the average intensity of multidimensional poverty in that society, which is 75%. It means that on average, a poor household in this society is expected to face 75% of the deprivations that they can face. Okay? So it's a measure of depth of multidimensional poverty. And once you see that, of course, these two aspects, which are both important, can be combined in a composite index, which is called the multidimensional poverty index, properly said, which is a simple multiplication of both. So it's an index that takes into account both intensity and incidence of poverty to judge the overall amount of poverty that you can find in a society if you want. So these new elements, as far as we know in the literature, have not been investigated in or contrasted with conflict. Because we do see a lot of very rich analysis when it comes to isolated deprivations, but this element of the depth or the proportion of deprivations faced by households is not necessarily investigated to a similar extent. So this is precisely what we set to do in the paper. And for this, we take into account 3 countries, so Ethiopia, Congo, and Algeria. And to measure this well-being aspects, we draw upon the demographic and health surveys conducted by USAID in developing countries for one particular reason, and it is the international comparability and harmonization of those surveys. Of course, it's not the only source of that kind of information. It is perhaps not the best, but it is certainly the one that assures to a greater extent comparability between countries. If we were to conduct, for example, a study specifically on Nigeria or specifically in Ethiopia, then perhaps we can have other options that are more suitable to cover different aspects more comprehensively for those particular countries. Now, of course, many aspects can be covered, and we're drawing upon one particular version of this Global Multidimensional Poverty Index. That is the one that UNDP produces each year for the developing world. Basically, the UNDP and us, we construct every year for every developing country a multidimensional poverty index that takes into account health, education, and living standards. In health, we take into account the nutritional aspect of the household, as measured by the Z-scores to detect malnutrition among children, child mortality occurring in the last 5 years preceding the survey, and under 5 mortality, of course, years of schooling, and school attendance are indicators of education, years of schooling in terms of school attainment, if you want, and school attendance in terms of children who are deprived of their access to school or are just being out of school for a certain reason. And then when it comes to living standards, we have 6 indicators. Cooking fuel, and we consider a household to be deprived if they use some kind of solid fuels because of health concerns. Improved sanitation, we follow SDG standards to detect whether or not sanitations that are available for the household are compliant with what is considered to be improved by SDG standards. The same thing with safe drinking water, access to electricity. Flooring is also a very important aspect when it comes to health, and it's related to living conditions, because of course if you have a dirt floor, for example, you're much more prone to get some kind of diseases, and it will have negative spillovers in terms of health. And when it comes to asset ownership, we try to take into account basic livelihood assets, such as a refrigerator, or for communication purposes, a radio, or a TV, or a landline, or a phone, or for, say, being able to travel, we consider any kind of motorbike, or bicycle, or truck, or some kind of vehicle that allows people to move. So those are the 10 indicators that we consider. Again, that could be a subject of debate, but we're trying to shield ourselves from that for the time being, because this is one option that is already published in international work for international comparisons using this data. So that is for the well-being aspect of the work. When it comes to the conflict aspect of the work, now, of course, if well-being is multidimensional, conflict is, again, multidimensional, of course, as well, and there are many aspects of conflict. So we try to draw on a net framework to conceptualize and perceive what are the aspects of conflict that we want to contrast our measure of well-being with. And her framework, I don't know if you know the framework, I'm sure you do. And if not, perhaps I'm not the best person to explain that. Perhaps you know much more than me. But you would have a very rich framework where she analyzes four different aspects of conflict that are changing across time and across space. So basically, you would have different groups, for example. You would have different forms of conflict. You would have different means, and you would have different places. And of course, you will have different consequences. Based on data limitations, we're not able to take into account every single aspect of conflict that she proposes in a very comprehensive framework. But we're trying to see whether or not we detect differences in terms of the form of conflict. So we analyze different forms of conflict. We analyze, of course, different places, and I'm going to get into that in a different slide. And of course, we heavily draw on, when it comes to the consequences, we actually challenge the fact that consequences can be overlooked if we take different strands or we take different approaches that are a little bit thinner or a little bit more simplistic when it comes to assessing well-being. Now, in terms of data, since this is at an exploratory stage, we're trying to draw on ACLED data. We are well aware of its limitations, but also one has to admit that it is one of the data sets that is perhaps one of the most known, at least in I'm an economist, in the economics literature. It is very widely spread, it is very widely used, even though it is based from the journals, and we know exactly what limitations lie. But since we're trying to explore what we can say in terms of this connection of frameworks, then we just adopted that for the preliminary exercise. So here you have Nigeria. The darker colors represent higher levels of poverty as measured by our proposal. So you would have a higher intensity and proportion of people who are poor. So we're taking into account not only the proportion of people who are poor, but also how poor they are. So it's the combination of both. The darker the color, the poorer the region. So you can see that, of course, in Nigeria, the northern regions are the poorest. Yeah? And they're also, here very concentrated in Borno, they're also regions where you have a lot of ongoing conflict. Here, the size of the bubble is representative of the fatalities associated to each conflict, and each dot is a conflict. Right? So here what we're trying to see is what kind of unit of analysis we can actually use for our paper. We are limited by DHS data, so the well-being data. The lowest level that we can attain, in this case, is the 37 states of Nigeria. So we have data has been collected from every single state, and it is representative at that level. We would actually go to have a more granular perspective and a more people-centered perspective, but of course we're not allowed to say what's happening with people. Yeah? We can only say what's happening on average in a certain region, because of data representativity, right? So the unit of analysis can be the region. We know that that's troubling, because what border do you put into the conflict? So borders are fuzzy. So we try to see to what extent we can account for that in the model-based analysis. But we do have, for the sake of data limitations, we do have to respect the level of representativity of the data. So our unit of analysis has to be the political boundaries in the region. And we do see that we have data even from the most conflictive areas that is intended to be representative because of the sampling design. Now, this is the evolution of conflict and poverty in Nigeria. So you can see that over the 5 years that I present here, poverty has been constantly being elevated in the northern regions. It has always been lower in the southern regions, in Lagos here, for example. And conflict has been ongoing over the regions. You will see that we detect a change in the levels of poverty by 2017, yeah, where we have slight movements, but in the end, the situation has not changed dramatically. Basically, in our study, in a separate study, Nigeria, out of the three countries, is the only one for which we don't detect any kind of evolutions in terms of welfare or well-being, as measured by this framework that we present, So basically, the level of well-being has been stagnant. But it has been stagnant both in the poor regions and in the least poor regions. When it comes to Ethiopia, for example, we see a different configuration. We see that poverty, of course, is much more prevalent in the Somali region and in Afar. But then when it comes to detecting changes, actually the whole country has reduced poverty overall. So they have improved, even though conflict was ongoing. Yeah? And then you can see that conflict was really prevalent even in Oromia, where it's a different, of course, it's the least poor region, but it is very prevalent in terms of conflict. But it has maintained its status as being one of the least poor regions in the country. When it comes to Congo, for example, you see a different picture. You see a much more homogeneous aspect when it comes to poverty. They're all very poor. But then you also see that poverty has been reconfigured over the years when we detect changes. And you can see that, well, in the Kivus, for example, or in Oriental, for example, poverty has actually reduced. Yeah. So you can see that here, for example, we see a positive change when it comes to welfare in Oriental. Well, there are so many conflicts in the Kivus that we cannot see how it moved, but it actually remained the same. So, of course, what we can say with this in terms of numbers? So how do we relate this when it comes to actual significance and differences when it comes to regions? So I will very briefly explain this because I know that this is not the most interesting part for a lot. But we basically say, okay, what we can do is we can have a unit of analysis which is the subnational region because of data limitations. However, we would be very wrong to say that conflict in one region affects people only in that region, or that people in one region is only affected by conflict in that region. Yeah? Because in the end, the whole country is connected by economic systems, right? So we try to cover the extent to which we can have spatial spillovers. Yeah? And we try to see whether or not we can detect whether neighboring regions are actually affecting, conflict occurring in neighboring regions are affecting poverty status in the region itself, aside of the proper direct effect of conflict in that precise region. So that is what this model stands for. So here I'm sure that perhaps most of you would recognize this equation, where this would be the dependent variable, which is in turn the intensity, the incidence, or the combination of both. Here you have the number of conflicts in different periods in time. So here I make the difference between the moment that we were measuring welfare, which is T, and then S, the moment of the conflict, which can be actually before. So we have a time dependence. Yeah. So S is any time in any period in time that is lower than S or equal. And then here you have an element that is very special to the spatial models, which accounts for not only conflict occurring in region I, but the vector of conflicts. Oh, sorry. But the vector of conflict occurring in all the country. Yeah. So at one point in time. This is why we omit the individual index here. And then these conflicts are activated through a weighting matrix that is an n by n matrix that activates conflicts in neighboring regions for different points in time. This is the coefficient that captures spatial spillovers. If this coefficient is significant at a certain level, then we can see and we can detect whether or not conflicts in neighboring regions have an effect say pure or net of the direct effect of conflict in that precise region. So that is the way we can account for this kind of spatial spillovers, if you want, while respecting the unit of analysis that data mandates, without breaking the representativity of the data. So I hope that that's clear. Then I guess that we can go back to that if you want. And then here I'm just going to present some preliminary results that we have. We do have much more results, but I'm going to focus on a couple that already point to the fact that there is something to say. And we try to distill a little bit more, putting it much more into context. So here, for example, we focus on conflict type 1. Conflict type 1 are battles, according to Euclid's definition. And we first don't take into account any kind of special spatial spillovers. And we consider that only direct effects, so conflicts happening in one region, have an effect on the livelihood of people in that region. So we're oblivious to the spillover term. Here you have poverty as measured, or well-being, lack of well-being as measured by the proportion of people who live in poverty, the intensity at which they experience poverty, and the combination of both. Here you have the countries that are represented in different colors. The dot represents the main point, the main estimate. the lines represent the confidence intervals of that estimate, and if they touch zero, they're non-significant. If they cross zero, they're non-significant. And this is at a 95% confidence. In the horizontal axis, you have the lag. So lag zero means that we take into account contemporaneous conflicts. Lag one means conflicts occurring the year before data for well-being was observed. Lag two represents 2 years before that, and so on and so forth. So what we can see here, for example, is that first of all, we do have we detect a lot of contemporaneous effects in terms of battles. So conflicts occurring at one particular point in time have a very strong significant effect, or have a very strong significant association in this case, with levels of well-being as measured by the proportion of people and as measured by the intensity at which they suffer poverty. But then we also see that, of course, longer-term conflicts occurring at longer periods in time in the past still have some effect, but to a much lower extent. What is interesting here, for example, is if you see what happens in Congo. So if we try to measure well-being by the proportion of people who suffer poverty, then we would reach no conclusion. So we would see that actually the proportion of people who face poverty has not been changed, not by contemporary conflicts, nor by past conflicts. But if you see what happens with the intensity at which poor people suffer poverty, it has actually increased. So that already tells us something about the kind of people who are affected by this particular type of conflict occurring in Congo. It is not necessarily more people who are going to be falling into poverty. So it is not people who are at the verge of falling into poverty because they're around the poverty line. But it is mostly affecting the intensity at which people who are already below the poverty line are suffering. And that not only for the contemporaneous conflicts, but also for the ones that occurred in the past. So this you cannot see if you don't disentangle this effect and if you don't take into account the joint distribution that I was mentioning before. So we can also see that in the case of Ethiopia and Nigeria, for example, that the effect goes both sides. So it's not only associated to the fact that you have more proportion of people living in poor areas, but it is also associated to the fact that people who were already poor are suffering from poverty in terms of intensity. Now, this is what we find with no special spillovers for conflict type 1. If we change the form of conflict, then we get different results. And that's where we try to engage with Ahmed's rich framework about how to define conflict. If we change the concept of conflict, and we measure conflict not necessarily by battles, but by riots and protests, then we get a different picture. In the case of Ethiopia, for example, we don't detect any kind of effect. We have a large variation, but we don't detect any kind of effect. And in the case of Nigeria, for example, we see that this type of conflict has actually been more associated with an increase of the proportion of people being poor rather than people who were already poor being less poor, or being poorer in terms of intensity, right? So the effect seems to be much more significant in terms of the proportion of people. So, of course, we have to dig into that, but we think that that means that a different kind of population is affected by this type of conflict, by this form of conflict. People who are perhaps nearer to the poverty line, yeah? Now, this is with no specialist spillovers. What if we take into account that borders are fuzzy and that conflicts in neighboring regions can actually affect people living in other regions, which is likely to be the case. But we're trying to see whether we can capture that with the data that we have at hand. So here, this is a little bit more complicated. But okay, so in column, in yeah, that's why I'm showing some results, because we have many results. In rows, we have the proportion, the effects or the associations with the proportion of people living in poverty. Yeah? Here, in the second row, we have the intensity of poverty, as measured by the proportion, the average proportion of deprivations that they face. And here we have the combination of both. So those are the rows. In columns, you have the countries. You have Congo, you have Ethiopia, and you have Nigeria. The colors here now represent the lag. So in this case, green represents contemporaneous conflicts. This color, orange, represents conflicts occurring the year before, and so on, okay? And then you separate what we call the direct effects from the indirect effects. Yeah? The indirect effects are effects caused, or associations caused, by not conflict occurring in that region, by conflict occurring in the neighboring regions, right? So in Congo, we don't detect any kind of neighboring effect or spatial spillovers. But in Ethiopia, for example, you do see a short-term effect, which is quite significant in terms of indirect effects. So you see that neighboring regions in Ethiopia, one region in Ethiopia, on average, tends to suffer from conflict occurring in the neighboring regions as well, to a great extent, when it comes to contemporaneous conflicts. Then the extent of the indirect effect reduces over time. So we see a large indirect short-term effect of conflict type one, that means battles, in Ethiopia. It's interesting to see that in Nigeria, for example, we see a much longer standing effect. So we see that conflict in neighboring regions not only affects welfare status of people in other regions contemporaneously, but also we detect very strong significant indirect effects over time. So it is a more persisting time of type of indirect effect. When it comes to changing again the nature of conflict, and we think of what happens with neighboring conflicts, but not as measured by battles, but as measured by riots and protests, then again, in Congo we don't detect any kind of spatial spillovers. In Ethiopia, we detect some kind of spatial spillovers, but again, only contemporaneous, not over time. And then again, in Nigeria, this type of conflict seems to be very prevalent, but only in the short term, not necessarily in the long term. Yeah, which kind of makes sense, but we have to dig a little bit more into that and contextualize the results that we're getting. So this is the kind of results that we're able to produce by combining both this new aspect well-being measure. Sorry, one thing that I meant that I forgot to mention is, one thing that is important here is that the effect, for example, the spillover effect here is as strong in terms of the proportion of people as it is for the intensity of poverty. So it not only pushes people, say, below the poverty line, but it also intensifies the extent to which they experience poverty in terms of indirect effects. Okay? So we do see that there are some things that can be said when we think about this welfare aspect, and we don't only focus on one particular aspect, which is monetary related, but we focus on an array of things that affect people's lives or that are important for people's lives, and we assess their interconnection. We're also seeing that a NETS framework is very relevant in the sense that how you define conflict or what aspect of conflict you're actually seeing will have an effect on the kind of results that you have to make, because if you define some kind of violent protest, for example, as conflict, or a battle as conflict, then you will have different results, because there are different forms of conflict, of course. And then we also see that you can actually say that with existing secondary data. Of course, much more can be said if we go into the field and if we conduct some very, very precise in-depth analysis of each particular case. But what is interesting here, and the point that we want to make, is that you already have some kind of data available, which of course is not perfect and it has limitations, but it allows you to say a little bit more than you can currently find in the literature in terms of the association between conflict and welfare. So as some concluding remarks, again, I think that one aspect that we want to highlight in the paper when it's going to be written is the fact that the link between conflict and intensity of poverty needs to be more carefully assessed. Because for the time being, we're seeing if the status of somebody not being able to go to school has changed, of somebody not having a mental problem developing one, but we don't see the extent to which people who already face these kind of problems have actually improved, have actually deteriorated their situation even worse, or we don't see the extent to which several aspects of people's lives have been reconfigured and conflict has simultaneously affected purchasing power and school attendance and flooring and access to drinking water, etc. We also detect indirect effects. I guess that this is not necessarily a novelty per se, because we already know that, you know, conflict does not necessarily conform to political boundaries. Not subnationally, not internationally. But then what can we say if we only have data that is representative at certain subnational levels? It's a mistake to try to go beyond that, right? That's disrespect to the sampling frame, and you cannot do that. So one way of doing that is by acknowledging that the units that you can define as unit of analysis that are correct can actually have spillover effects to their neighboring regions. That is one way of taking that into account. And actually spatial models have been increasingly used in this kind of research. And indeed, there are some things that can be said using this kind of frameworks that deserve more attention. Of course, we want to extend this study to other types of conflict and say qualify conflicts, because for the time being the results that I mentioned are related to the number of conflicts, but that's a crude measure of a conflict. It needs to be qualified in many respects. So we try to come up with a cleaner quantifier or a cleaner qualifier of conflict. For example,
using fatalities or other aspects that try to refine a little more this measure that we have, that for the time being it's very crude, or the actors who perpetrated the conflict. And well, of course, we want to assess what happens if we adapt these models and this framework to other data. Perhaps not accurate data, but other types of data, such as UCDP, for example. Which, of course, we need to reconceptualize the way, the types of conflict that we can envision, because the kind of data that we have is different. And then this we see as some kind of entry door or a preliminary analysis to more in-depth analysis. Because one thing that we do not want to claim in the paper is that this is a generalization of what happens in, say, sub-Saharan Africa or in the context. So it is very context-dependent, because conflicts, each country and each conflict is fundamentally different, is structurally different. It has a different history. So we first want to have a regional perspective of what we can say and what is the context of each particular country. But then, of course, country-specific analysis will shed a much clearer light on the evolution of that conflict. And then even, well, if we can, we can see the extent to which this approach can be operationalized through quasi-experimental approaches. But that, again, requires digging very deep into one specific case and not necessarily trying to uncover cross-national differences. And of course, we don't want to merely describe what happens, but we also want to understand the mechanism to which that happens. So we want to assess and dig a little bit more into the economic and political mechanisms that are reconfigured for the results to make sense. So we try to not only remain at the low-hanging fruits of just describing the data, but we try to see to what extent we can actually link our results to policy and economic mechanisms that are reconfigured in the period of analysis that we're conducting. So as I mentioned, this is preliminary research. We are very excited to moving this forward. And again, thank you for giving us a chance to present this in this platform, where we actually need and we will value a lot of comments and feedback from you, who are experts, much more than perhaps we are in this subject. So thank you very much.